Well, thank you, Paul. It's my privilege to be here to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the Footprints Foundation. We were here for the 50-year celebration as well for the Footprints poem. So we've known Paul and Margie for, a long time. And let me just give you a little bit of history so you'll understand the context of what I'm speaking on, because I appreciate Paul and Marge's ministries and the legacy that they have established for that. And so Paul asked me to speak today on the apologetics forum that we formed back in 4 years ago, actually, in 2013. But I've been doing apologetics for quite a few years before then, and I'll explain that. But just to give you a little bit of a history, you may or may not know, my wife and I were both born in Holland. And after the war, you know, some of you will remember the Second World War, which I was born in the middle of, my parents decided to immigrate to Canada. And we actually ended up going in 1948. My parents got, had us reserved on a boat. They got on a boat in Rotterdam. I said, well, I might as well get on it too, right? So I did. So we immigrated to Canada. We landed up in a place that some of you may know, and that is Imbro, not, I don't think, very far from here. And my dad was a farmer and a carpenter, and he was obligated to work for a farmer for a year at that time. And so that's what he did. So we started there, and then a year later, we moved to that big city on Lake Huron called Kamlaki. Some of you may even know where that is. And it's interesting, you know, how our legacies are tied together. The Footprints, Paul's ministry, and our ministry in apologetics and girders and quilting and all that. Actually, in 1949, we moved to Kamlaki. My parents had, I'm one of 10 children, but only half of us immigrated to Canada. The other half were born in Canada. And at that 49, I don't know when Paul became aware of our family, but Gerda read his book many, many years later and said, in Kamlaki, I remember this Dutch family that moved in and had a lot of children. He didn't know who we were. I didn't know who he was, of course. And many years later, we discovered through Gerda's reading that it was our family that he was referring to. He didn't know, and he only came to know that much later on, I think, that it was really our family. Gerda's family moved to, immigrated later on, 52, to Listowel, and we actually met in Burlington, Ontario, back in 55. That's when we moved to Burlington, and our families met in a church setting, and eventually we became friends and better and got married in 64. And so... And I realized also, we didn't know at the time, of course, Margie wrote her poem in 64 as well. And then Gerda alluded to the fact that she met Margie at a church that we were going to in New Jersey. I think it was 73, 74 time frame. And Gerda and her happened to sit together. They compared notes. And that's why she became known as the Footprints Lady and Gerda as the Dutch Lady. And so that was the first introduction. We've not met Paul at all at that time. Later on, our families moved to California and then to Washington State, which is where we live now. And then in 1996, we were in a church which was very supportive of missions, and Paul and Marge came to that church to do their missions work there. I was involved in the missions committee already at that time. And Gerda said at that time, I know you somewhere, and she was relating that story, and eventually they figured out it was back in New Jersey, which was, 22 years later. And we had not met Paul, at least we didn't think we had met Paul before, but Gerda looked at him when he came in 1996 and said, I know you. But again, she couldn't figure out from where. Well, it turns out we knew Paul because he ran Youth for Christ in Hamilton, and Gerda and I were dating in the early 60s, and we went there for our Saturday night dates to Youth for Christ, of all places, and there was Paul. I didn't remember his name or anything like that, but when we got together in 96, you know, we filled in the blanks and understood where we all had met. So that was the interesting connection between our two families. And later on, Marge had asked Gerda to write a chapter in her two Footprints books, and she did. And one of our granddaughters, actually, the daughter of our oldest daughter, Audrey, wrote a poem in there because she loves to write poetry. And the other thing I should mention, Audrey is our oldest daughter. She was born in Ottawa. And Gerda and her were shopping one day and came into a drugstore. I think there was 73 or so before Gerda had even met Marge, and saw this poem, Footprints. And Audrey, who was about 8 years old at the time, said, "Mom, that's a beautiful poem. I'd like to get that." And Gerda bought a copy of that, so we became familiar with the Footprints poem. And then a year later in New Jersey, when Gerda and Marge met, you know, that's how they got that relationship, because, you know, Gerda said, finally made the connection with Marge writing that poem. That's how we got in touch with each other, and that's, I appreciate Paul and Marge, you know, legacy ministry with Footprints, and of course Paul's ministry as well. So what about the legacy of the apologetics form, which Paul alluded to, that I formed in 2013? And how did that come to be? Well, it actually started with our oldest daughter. Her name was Audrey, and she, like I said, she was born in Ottawa. She went to public school in New Jersey, and by the time she got to fourth grade, she came home one day from school and said to Gerda, who was home, "You know, the teacher says we came from a monkey." Oh, that's a problem. So I immediately got interested, because we were very strong believers. I come from a very strong Christian background, and I believe in the biblical record of creation. And so I knew I had to do something. This would have been 1973 or so, something like that. And I had got my degree, actually, in nuclear physics, a doctorate in nuclear physics at McMaster University, which was, you know, the nuclear school at the time, the only one with a nuclear reactor. So I knew science, I knew the Bible, and by that time, when Audrey came home, I said, "I need to do something about this." So I got very interested in studying the Bible and what science says, and to make sure they agreed, because in my mind, if God is who He says He is, then His word and His work on earth, His creation, must match. They got to tell the same story. And there are scientific statements in the Bible that you may know, which are surprising. People are surprised that the biblical statements on science are actually correct. We may not have known that they were correct even a few hundred years ago, but now we know that they really do tell the truth. So I was concerned about our children, of course, and then got involved in developing a set of lectures on creation versus evolution. That's the big stumbling block for a lot of young people. Today, it is the major stumbling block, I would submit. And so people need to understand, our youth need to understand, you know, that the Bible, when it speaks on science, it does tell the truth. So I got involved in that, and my wife Gerda and I have been very involved in missions. So we support, and our church supports a number of missionaries around the world, including a Nepalese person and a Thai person, and missionaries in Eastern Europe, well, all over Europe. So I was chairman of the missions committee for 10 years at our church in Washington. So I knew a lot of the leaders, evangelical leaders in those countries. And so I got involved in teaching at Bible schools overseas, you know, developing courses on apologetics, not just on creation versus evolution, but also just general Christian apologetics and biblical worldview. And if you look at our flyers back there, that's what we talk about there, because that's what our apologetics is all about. So we've been involved in going overseas for, I think about 2003 or so, so, you know, 14, 15 years by now. And so part-time, and I could schedule that time because I have my own high-tech business, internet business. And so we went over a number of times per year and gave lectures at churches, schools, even secular schools, and you know, Bible schools and different churches. We just came back from a trip to Croatia, where you know, I spoke at probably 10 different churches in our trip there, and Gerda did some quilting ministries. We're very familiar, or I'm very familiar with what's involved in apologetics, but you may ask the question, well, what is apologetics? Well, a lot of skeptics and unbelievers are saying there, you know, like the new atheists, like Dawkins, you know, Richard Dawkins, the well-known atheist in England, said, you're, what you believe to be true is based on faith. Science has all the facts. Well, it's not an issue between science and our faith. Evolutionists have faith too. They have faith that evolution really happened. And I can show from a science point of view that there is no good science behind evolution at all. That's my focus in apologetics. So they'll tell us that our faith is blind and we don't have any facts to back up what we believe. But I would say, yes, we do. Here's some of the things they would say. The Bible contradicts itself. It's not true. Genesis 1 and 2, they tell two different stories about creation. People in Moses' days couldn't even write. How could Moses have written the first five books of the Bible? The Hittites mentioned in the Old Testament never even existed, is what skeptics said. How do you know that's true? Sodom and Gomorrah were not real places. Yeah, if you read Genesis 14:2, talks about the five cities of the plains. They said they never even existed. Scientific statements in the Bible, they can't be believed. So how do we answer these questions of skeptics? Well, I'll tell you. First of all, we have to remember there's a real issue, a challenge in defending our faith. According to the latest Barna polls, 26% of Christians don't think it matters which religion one follows. They all teach the same basic lesson, so why does it matter? But that's Christians saying that. 40% of Christians say Christians and Muslims worship the same God. You may have heard of a Chrislam movement, and you know that's not true. Only 9% of adult Americans have a biblical worldview. 30% of American adults believe in absolute truth. You know, just think about that for a minute. You know, they would say there's no such thing as an absolute truth. How do you refute that? Ask them, is the statement that you made absolutely true? Self-defeating. I mean, they have arguments like that. You just don't make sense. But here's the frightening thing. Only 9% of born-again teenagers believe that absolute truth exists. And at least 60% of the children from evangelical homes, even the ones that went to church and went through Sunday school, they leave the faith once they go to secular universities. And some even leave the faith after they go to, you know, liberal Christian colleges. We have to be aware of that. We are losing our youth because of what they're being taught. We need to understand the reasons for this challenge. And the two reasons I would give, the two predominant reasons are indoctrination of our youth in secularism and evolution. They're indoctrinated with that in the public school system. You know, that's the truth. Forget your religion. And in some cases, they are getting no answers from the church for the hard questions that they ask of the church leaders. Where they say, well, just take that on faith. Okay? And don't question it, just take it on faith. Well, if they can't get their questions answered in the church, when they go to secular college, they're going to ask somebody else. You may not like the answer that they get. So it's our obligation as a church to make sure that they are taught. You know, we may not have all the answers, but we have most of the answers at this point in time. And if you don't know them, if I don't know them, I know where to refer them for answers to their questions. So we'll find in churches, you may know people too, who don't know exactly what they believe, why they believe it, and how to defend what they believe. That's what apologetics is all about. We need to arm them. We need to equip them so that they can answer the hard questions. that they're asked. And Peter, in 1 Peter 3:15, commands us to be always ready to defend for the hope that we have within us. In other words, we need to be able to defend what we believe to be true. You will have been told by some people, well, when you go to church, just leave your mind at the door as you go into the door, into the church, and then after you come back out, then you can pick up your mind again and get things going. Use your logic and reason, which God gave us. So, no, that's not true. Even Jesus says in Matthew 22:37, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, all your mind, all your mind. So we are given reason and logic by God. Yeah, we're made in the image of God. We're different from animals. So we can answer their questions through this logic. Jude 3, I found it necessary, where Jude writes, to write appealing to you to contend for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. So we need to know what our faith is and be able to contend for that, to defend it. Paul, in Acts 17, verse 11, they received the word with all eagerness, examining the scriptures daily to see if these things were so. In other words, be good Bereans. Check it out. You know, don't believe what I tell you, and I include myself in that. Check it out for yourself. You know, if I say it's wrong biblically, then check it out. If I say the science doesn't support it, check it out. Sometimes when I argue my case, what the answer I'll get from skeptics is, oh, you're just another one of those flat earthers. Well, I don't believe in a flat earth. You know, why does he call me that? Well, that's the ad hominem attacks you tend to get. If they can't answer your question through the facts, they'll just call you something and say, oh, he's off the wall. And, you know, that's not how I think. Paul further in 1 Thessalonians 5:21, test everything, hold fast what is good. And the other thing that's so important is we need to understand the times that we live in. The writer of Chronicles says, 1 Chronicles 12:32, of Issachar, men who had understanding of the times to know what Israel ought to do. In other words, men who understood the times. And that's our mission too. We need to understand the times we live in. We're faced with a lot of challenges in our culture, and we need to be able to address them from a biblical perspective. So why do people not come to faith? Well, I would say that there are six major roadblocks to that. And the first is just lack of knowledge. They say, I don't have enough knowledge to believe in God. But you know, you go back to Hosea 4:6, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. But God is evident in nature. You know, Paul reminds us in the book of Romans, first chapter, verses 19 to 22, for what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. I mean, look at the complexity of the universe that God created. How do you explain the 100 billion galaxies out there and about 100 billion stars per galaxy? And they're all different. You know, they have different characteristics. The complexity of the human cell. I mean, just think, if you believe that life starts from a single cell, and we do, science can prove that now, look at the complexity. How probable mathematically is it that all of those parts could fit together and work at the beginning? If there was no intelligent mind behind that, it can't happen randomly. Don't you know, Darwin didn't know the complexity of the human cell when he came up with the theory of evolution. So you can excuse him for that. But we know today that the complexity is such it could just not, mathematically, it's improbable. No, sorry, not improbable, impossible that it could form just by chance. It just cannot. So we have plenty of evidence. Paul also reminds us in Romans 2 that we have a conscience. You know, we know the difference between good and evil. It reminds me of a headhunter who came to Christ in Latin America. The missionary asked him, you know, this is probably after 15, 20 years, they were headhunters, they came to Christ. And then the missionary asked them, you know, you're cutting out people's head. Didn't you know that was wrong? yes, we knew it was wrong, but we did it anyway. So it's man's evil heart that caused him to do wrong. You know, we are fallen and we do bad things as human beings. Second reason why people don't come to Christ is because they look at Christians. They look at us very carefully. And if we live a hypocritical life, they'll say, why do I want to be one of those hypocrites too? That's an excuse. You know, I don't use other people's hypocrisy as a reason not to believe. You know, that I'm a believer despite what other Christians might do. Accepting Christ would require turning away from sin. It's a moral issue. 4, pain, suffering, and evil in the world. If God is all-loving and all-powerful, why do we have pain and suffering? Why do we have evil in the world? You know, God could stop it. And that is one of the hardest questions that skeptics have. And I've done lectures on that overseas, you know, many times, but it really came home to me 4 years ago when we lost our daughter, Audrey, our oldest daughter. And so I had to work my way through that, of course, but my lecture became more real because of that. 5, the perceived conflict between science and the Bible. You know, is the Bible reliable scientifically? We have to be able to answer that question. And then the whole creation versus evolution. If you look at the first chapter of Genesis, you know, the order of events where God spoke things into existence, that is totally different from evolution. Is totally different. The order in evolution is different. You know, the random chance stuff is totally different. They just don't match. No matter how hard you try, you can't match them. So that was my challenge, of course. In college, when I first went to college at McMaster University, went to a geology class, the professor said, forget what you were taught in the Bible, in church, you know, here's how it really happened. Look at those layers of sediments. They show us what happened in the past. Well, that depends on your presuppositions. And so I knew I had a challenge. My thesis advisor was also an atheist. And he knew I was a believer, and he thought, well, you're just using Christianity as a crutch. You know, that was his view of what I was doing. It was interesting. I had another colleague that went to Master University who was an atheist at the time, but his thesis advisor was a very strong Christian, so totally reverse of that. And it turns out, when he became 40 and heard the gospel for the first time, he became a believer, and he's now a creationist scientist, and he speaks on the topic of creation and science and how science supports creation. So he had a different environment than I had, but he came to faith because he heard the gospel. So people can change their minds. And the 6th thing I mentioned before, no answers from the church to the hard questions. Even those that go to Sunday school, that's not any guarantee that they're going to come out and hold onto their faith when they're challenged by the secular university professors. And, you know, I know what they fear because I've talked to many of them. I talked to a lot of skeptics. And if you remember 1 Peter 3:15, we are to do it with gentleness and respect. You don't say, how come you don't see that? Are you a dummy or something? No, that's not how you keep that conversation going. I keep an open conversation going. And I can't argue them into the kingdom, but I can plant the seed. And that's my obligation, to plant the seed. So, postmodern challenges to the church. First of all, we need to know how to defend our faith. That's what apologetics is all about, 1 Peter 3:15. We need to be able to discern and confront error. You know, when we see error in teaching, you know, wrong doctrine, false gospels, we need to point that out too. That's it being offensive as opposed to defensive. And then 3rd, I say, is distraction from true worship. We get so involved with the world that we forget who we worship and who we revere. So that's what apologetics is all about. And we have, of course, classical arguments that Christian philosophers have used over the centuries. First of all, there's a science law which says every effect has a cause. There's a cause for everything. you know, the glass on the table here, for example, it's not just going to roll over and fall off. Somebody's got to push it. And so there's a cause for every effect that we see. And so if we see the universe, you know, there must have been a cause for the universe. And if you go back far enough in time, what is that first cause? And that cause is God. You know, that is the first cause. There's no other answer to that question. We have a design that we can see in the universe. We have a design we can see in our cell system. You know, doctors understand, you know, how life starts, how human life starts. And it just as one example, I mean, the first cell duplicates into 2, into 4, 8, 16, and so on. And they're all the same, identical. And then all of a sudden, you know, some of those cells turn into blood cells, bone cells, hair cells, eye cells, you know, what have you. 200 different types of cells in your body. How do the cells know when to start differentiating? If they did at the wrong time, you know, we wouldn't be here to talk about it. If things happen randomly, we wouldn't be here to talk it. There's some program in that cell. Even Bill Gates, the founder of Microsoft, says the information in the human cell is so much more complex than my Windows operating system. You know, orders of magnitude more complex. And you know, if you change one bit in the operating system, it's going to crash. It's not going to run properly. So you know our program is, our cells are programmed exactly the way they need to be to produce life. You can't explain that by random mutations. It just doesn't happen that way. And then you have the moral argument. If there's a moral law, there must be a moral lawgiver as well. How do I look at the Bible? Well, first of all, the Bible is God's word. It is inerrant in the original autograph, and it is authoritative, and it's inspired, and I take it as that. So what evidence do I have for that? Well, if you look at Scripture, you'll know most of you would accept that it's spiritual truth. When it talks on spiritual matters, it's true, yep. But science, I don't know, or other sciences, I don't know, other disciplines. However, we have now know through archaeology that it is also verifies the truth of the Bible. All the digs they have done in the biblical lands, you know, they show that these things that the Bible talks about really did exist back then. There is evidence. Some things we haven't found evidence for, and some things we may never find evidence. But from my point of view, we have found enough evidence to verify the truth of the Bible. If you look at the history in the Bible, you look at secular history and geography, you know, the places that are mentioned in the Bible, did they exist? Yes. You look at the Book of Mormon, for example, which was written in 1830, and it talks about Joseph Smith finding the golden plates in the Hill of Cumorah. Where's the Hill of Cumorah? He wrote this in 1830. Why can't he tell us? You know, there's no archaeology to prove it at all. And Mormon archaeologists understand that. They don't have the evidence from archaeology to show that the Book of Mormon is true. We do. Going back thousands of years, we know that the Bible speaks the truth. In history, Dr. Luke, who wrote the Gospel according to Luke and the Book of Acts, is known to be one of the most accurate historians of all time. He mentions about 30 different nations and islands, people, the names of some of the rulers, you know, the titles of some of the rulers. And people, skeptics said, oh, those titles were never used. Well, they've now found artifacts which prove that all of those titles that Luke talks about were real titles back in those times. So archaeology, history, geography, confirm the truth in the Bible. And probably the best truth we have is that of prophecy. You know, most of you know that there's a lot of messianic prophecy which shows that they were fulfilled in the New Testament, and you know, you will believe that, you know, Christ is the Messiah, but you may not know that there's plenty of other prophecies as well about people, places, and things. And there's about 1,000 prophecies. More than 500 have already been proven to be true. And so prophecy confirms the truth of Scripture. And there's many examples of that I could go into, but we don't have the time. But I want to mention two archaeological finds of the last century, which are, I consider to be the most important that verify the truth of the Bible. First is the Dead Sea Scrolls, found in 1947-48 in the caves of Qumran in Israel. And they had copies of all the books of the Old Testament, except for the book of Esther so far. And so scholars could now compare a copy of the book of Esther, which was copied roughly 125 BC. The oldest book we had, the copy of Isaiah that we had before then, was about 1100 AD. So here you got 1200 years of difference. So scholars can compare, you know, copies of the book of Isaiah and all the other Old Testament books and say, is there any differences? You know, did our doctrine change over that time? Because skeptics said, yes, they did. They said Isaiah was written after the time of Christ. Well, now we know it was, you know, there was a copy that exists before the time of Christ. And so comparing that, scholars found that there's about 1% difference in the text of those two books, just as an example. Most of those differences were because of the changes in the Hebrew language over that period of time. So that's inconsequential. Yes, there were some, you know, T's that weren't crossed properly or dots that didn't appear properly, but nothing would change any of the Christian doctrines that we take for truth today. So we can have great confidence that the books of the Bible, the manuscripts, were copied carefully. The second one is the Dead Sea, or the Ebla tablets found in northern Syria in 1974, because people said, well, Moses couldn't have written the first five books of the Bible. And remember, Sodom and Gomorrah never existed, according to the skeptics. Well, here, the Ebla tablets disclosed about 5,000 different cities, towns in the biblical lands at the time. And they mention also the five cities of the plains, Sodom and Gomorrah and the other three. Those have been verified. And the fact that those records were written about 1,000 years before Moses would have put the first five books of the Bible together was 1,000 years later. So we know, obviously, people could write 1,000 years before Moses, and Moses said wrote those books. So this verifies that, yes, indeed, he could have written those, and he did write those books. Again, those two finds were very instrumental in confirming the truth of the scriptures that we have. And if I come to science, for example, just a few examples, Genesis 1:1. Remember, Moses was educated in the courts of the pharaohs, according to Paul in Acts, the book of Acts. And so he would have known the mythologies of the Greeks and the Egyptians at the time. What did he say in the very first verse? He said, in the beginning, and let me just... There's a scientist who came out in 1903 and said, everything can be explained in the universe by five different concepts. One is time, force, action, matter, and space. What did Moses write in the first verse? In the beginning, that's time, God, that's force, created, that's action, the heavens, that's space, and the earth, that's matter. How did he get that right? It's inspired. Leviticus 17:11. What does it say? The life of the flesh is in the blood. Well, how would Moses know that? You might remember that our President George Washington, he actually died because people tried to extract the disease out of his body by taking the blood out of his blood vessels. Well, if you read that verse, that's not how you do it. That's not how you heal. Circumcision, written about by Moses in the first five books of the Bible. When should a male child be circumcised? Day 8. Why 8? Well, scientists didn't know. But now medical scientists know that the baby's immune system is strongest on day 8, and that the blood clotting element is also the strongest on day 8. Why did Moses say 6 days or 10 days? How do you get it exactly right? You know? And there's many other statements like that, scientific statements, which are shown to be accurate today, which didn't know if they were accurate at the time. So anyway, the Bible is a very unique book. You know, there are 300 so-called holy books in the world, and the Bible is very unique. All those five things I mentioned up front that skeptics said were wrong, they've all been proven to be true. And, you know, there's many more examples of that, of course. So how does this fit into the apologetics forum? Well, based on our my experience in doing apologetics over the years, you know, we got involved in overseas, and our oldest daughter, Audrey, was very supportive of that. She was a very strong believer, and when she contracted this disease, you know, she knew that she may not, you know, be here that much longer. She informed us when we were on one of our missions trip in the 2012, while we were in Croatia at the time, and said, you know, the doctor just diagnosed me with this cancer. And so we came home, and the next year we spent looking after our daughter, Audrey. But we knew she had a strong faith, and whatever God's will was to be. And she regretted the fact that we didn't go overseas for more than a year, because we spent the time looking after her. Of course, that was the most important ministry for us at the time. But nevertheless, we were home for that long period of time, and that's when I was motivated to start the Apologetics Forum, a local forum where we bring in speakers on apologetics, and I speak on that too, to show that we have evidence to support what we believe. So we did that for a year, or well, more than a year. We did that, and I can do that because I'm of course grateful for my salvation, but also the sacrifice that my parents made for us as children, because they left the homeland, Holland, which was devastated by the war, and to give us a better opportunity. So I'm not going to waste that opportunity by just, you know, retiring and just doing nothing. That's not what God has in mind for me. And I felt I was in good position to use my God-given gifts in science and the Bible, and to show that they really do agree with each other. And then I happened to read John Piper's book, which said, "Don't waste your life." And he wrote, you know, about some people that would retire and then just collect seashells on the shore for the last 10 years of their life. Well, I said, I'm going to do something with my life. I better do something more than just collect seashells. And retirement, I regard as just, it's a change of career. You know, the word retirement doesn't exist in the Bible. And of course, we are very grateful for our daughter's testimony, Audrey's testimony, and her support. And we do this with greater zeal in her memory. She did a lot of things that we didn't even know about. In fact, she witnessed to her friends, and we didn't know that she had written a personal letter to each one of them, and saying, "If I'm no longer here, or if we've been raptured, or something like this, you know, here's where you can find the things I was talking about." And so she left those unopened letters for 13 of her friends, and we opened them after she passed away, of course, and. Yeah, it was a great encouragement to us as well. So we are to walk the talk, and I feel that's very important. If I'm not walking the talk, then forget what I say, because people won't listen to you. Use, like some preachers say, use words only when necessary, right? So we need to learn our faith, what we believe, why we believe it, and how to defend our faith. That's not just for pastors and missionaries. You know, everybody, it's written to everybody to do that. We're to learn the faith, to live the faith, to share the faith. And for me, being a scientist, it's very important that science be have integrity. Okay, if you look at the science behind evolution, I can show you there is none. There is no credible science behind evolution. And I don't know how you feel about global warming, but I recently also gave a talk on that, and I can show again, there is no science behind that. You know, I've studied that for 8 years and written commentaries on the internet, and there is no credible science. You know, carbon dioxide is such a minute greenhouse gas in the atmosphere, we can't control the climate. You know, we just can't. Man thinks he can control the climate. Man thinks he can control the progression of humankind. You know, Hitler was believed in evolution. He thought he was doing the world a favor, or evolution a favor, by eliminating, quote, the inferior races. And that's not what it's all about. So again, be careful when scientists claim that they, that like Richard Dawkins says, evolution is a fact. I can assure you it's not a fact. Barely a theory. So anyway, that's what we do as a ministry. There are some write-ups in the back for those that are interested. And I thank you for your attention.